Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
MATLAB and Simulink Software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now. Coming up, Ukraine peace talks between the U.S. and Russia ended with no breakthrough. Where are they stuck and what's next? We'll discuss.
Plus, billionaires Michael and Susan Dell promised to put $250 into investment accounts for millions of American kids.
When the child turns 18, it becomes like an IRA. They can use it for education, for starting a business, for buying a home, for starting a family.
Is that the best way to close the wealth gap? And if you know someone with dementia, some new hope, a common vaccine may slow down the symptoms.
So I think this only provides additional motivation to get the shingles vaccine.
Coming up Here and Now.
After this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump is pardoning Texas Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports Cuellar was a critic of former President Joe Biden's border policies.
Cuellar, who has represented his South Texas district since 2004, was indicted in 2024 for bribery and money laundering. The government charged him and his wife with accepting $600,000 from two foreign entities. The president announced in a post on social media he was pardoning both of them, saying, quote, "You can sleep well tonight. Your nightmare is finally over." He said the Biden administration went after Cuellar because he broke with his party on immigration. Cuellar thanked Trump, saying the pardon gives him a clean slate. House Republicans have repeatedly tried to defeat Cuellar. Several GOP candidates are running against him in 2026. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News.
Four former federal employees have filed a class action lawsuit against the Trump administration, challenging their firings. The group says they were unlawfully targeted because of their actual or perceived involvement with diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. We have more from NPR's Andrea Hsu.
The plaintiffs worked in the Department of Homeland Security, the Justice Department, the Office of Personnel Management, and the National Institutes of Health. They say the Trump administration's goal was to punish perceived political enemies, including federal employees it associated with ideologies embraced by former President Biden. President Trump issued two executive orders condemning what he called widespread and illegal use of race and sex-based preferences and accusing Biden of forcing DEI into government. The lawsuit argues the DEI-related firings disproportionately affected federal workers who are Black, women, non-binary, and people of color, as well as those seen as advocating for legally protected racial and gender groups. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Later this hour, President Trump's expected to announce changes in vehicle mileage rules for the auto industry. Critics have been concerned about any efforts to weaken the rules designed to support climate action. The GOP's protected its narrow majority in the House of Representatives with the election of Matt Van Epps in Tennessee's 7th District. President Trump endorsed the former Army helicopter pilot in the special election, while Trump's 2024 presidential rival, former Vice President Kamala Harris, campaigned for Democrat Afton Bain. In his victory speech, Van Epps says running with Trump is why he won.
Our victory was powered by supporters of President Trump turning out to vote. The president built the largest, most diverse coalition to ever elect a Republican, and we leaned in on that.
The race was viewed as a test of whether Democrats could make a comeback in next year's midterm elections. They had outperformed Republicans in other key contests nearly a month ago. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. A former Antioch police officer will serve 7.5 years in federal prison for his role in a corruption scandal involving officers in both Antioch and Pittsburgh. KQED's Julie Small reports.
Devin Wenger was convicted of conspiring with other officers to use excessive force, conspiring to distribute steroids, and destroying evidence. U.S. Judge Jeremy White said Wenger failed to show remorse or take responsibility for his actions, which he called reprehensible. The judge said the lengthy sentence was a response to Wenger's violation of the public trust. Claude Janet Young was the only victim to speak at the hearing.
I definitely thought he was going to get lesser time than what he got. So I'm actually happy that the judge took all his body language and everything from start to finish into consideration.
Wenger is the last of more than a dozen defendants in the police scandal to be sentenced. I'm Julie Small, KQED News.
Local air regulators are fining Chevron $900,000 for failing to properly monitor emissions at its Richmond refinery. The Bay Area Air District requires companies like Chevron to run air monitoring systems that augment government inspection, but a recent audit found 20 monitors that weren't working properly, and the company failed to fix them by a deadline. The Air District says that means that if emissions increase beyond legal limits, it could go undetected and unreported. Chevron has since addressed the issue, and the district says it's working on certifying the updated system. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from Postman, used by 40 million developers to build APIs that help AI make smarter decisions. More at postman.com. Support for NPR comes from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And the listeners of KQED. Windy, gusty winds today around the Bay Area, possibly up to 45 miles per hour later today with gusts down to 35 late afternoon. Coastal flood advisory, the king tides, the advisory through Sunday afternoon, high surf and sneaker waves, that advisory ends tonight.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington. This is Here and Now. A meeting between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and top U.S. officials is now off. Zelensky had been scheduled to meet White House envoys Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. Yesterday, the two Americans met with Russian leader Vladimir Putin, but no breakthrough there after 5 hours. And now, Putin is escalating his rhetoric and his threats. Here to update us is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. She's in Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital. Eleanor, hi.
Hi.
What do we know about the meeting between Putin and the Americans, Witkoff and Kushner, what the sticking points are?
Well, I don't think Putin was with the delegation the whole time. We don't know exactly what was in the document, but actually the Ukrainian-Russian sides are very far apart. And we never, in Ukraine, no one really thought Putin was going to sign this deal. So, you know, while they didn't take it to the next step, they both used words like constructive and productive. But the big takeaway yesterday was that what Russian President Vladimir Putin said, first of all, he said the Europeans had changed the draft to make it unacceptable to the Russians so they could blame it on Moscow when the deal failed, because he does not want the Trump administration to blame him for no peace. And so that was the big takeaway from yesterday.
Yeah. Two sides being far apart, how? Is this still about territory?
It's so deep. Look, Putin has not changed any of his maximalist demands, not from day one. And the Ukrainians, he's asking Ukrainians to leave the territory. He's talking about Ukraine. He's talking about cities of people who want to live under Ukraine that they've been protecting for 4 years. He wants them just to walk away and say, well, now you're under the Russian control. That's out of the question. And for Ukraine, they want security guarantees. They've got nothing on that. There's no common points. The sides are just too far apart right now.
You mentioned Putin's response to this, or, you know, trying to either escape blame or place blame on the Europeans for trying to stick it on him. How is all this now being received in Brussels, in Kyiv?
Well, I can tell you, I wasn't in Brussels, but I was watching a lot of French TV last night. And when Putin said that he didn't look for war with the Europeans, but he was ready for it. And he said this quote, and it's not going to be the kind of surgical operation that we have going on in Ukraine. I mean, the news channels there just blew up. It was the top of the news. I think the Europeans, they're panicked. They talk about war now all the time, building their armies. But they're also, they're determined. They're determined to support Ukraine. So that's the way it's being seen there. It's really, really taking a huge place now in society. They're reinstating military service in France. I mean, Germany's overhauling its whole military. In Ukraine, it was like, ho-hum, we never thought anybody was going to sign this deal anyway. I don't even think people were watching last night because they knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. And we should note, Eleanor, we're hearing
some generators in the background because there are power blackouts by you. So just you're yelling. No, we can hear you fine. Just thanks for this. Putin, for his part, not only accused European leaders of undercutting this process, he said Russia is prepared to fight a war with Europe if Russia were attacked. What is that about?
But that's what they're debating on all the news channels across Europe, and the leaders are hunkering down. And this is what the Ukrainians say. We are fighting for Europe. We are the front line. If Putin gets through us, you're next. And so that's why the Ukrainians want to work with the Europeans, and the Ukrainians keep saying you cannot make a peace deal with Putin. He does not want to stop. He's still bombing. I mean, every other night there's, you know, missile attacks here. People come out the next day, clean up, count the dead, and go forward. They've put up Christmas decorations. There's an amazing resilience here. But they can't just hold on forever, and the Europeans are slowly starting to realize that, yeah, perhaps Putin could. I mean, he's probably not going to go to Paris, but he could maybe invade one of the Baltics or Moldova. So the Ukrainians want to work with the Europeans, but nobody really knows what that means yet.
Yeah, wow. It struck me what you just said, Eleanor, that people trying to go about their lives as people are dying, regular attacks. I mean, how exhausted are you or the people in Ukraine right now?
Almost four years on. I mean, I can't say a thing because I've only been here a couple of weeks, but people are so exhausted. But they always say this, we don't have an alternative, because they know what Putin's regime is. They know that people are taken down to cellars and tortured, that the children deported. I mean, we see it. We see what's happened in the occupied territories. It's just a complete, you know, dictatorship, no freedoms. I mean, they don't want to live that way. They really feel European. Actually, when you come to Ukraine, you feel the European spirit more than you do in Western Europe. It's like these people here know what it means because they're fighting for something. So there's an incredible resilience here. Yes, people are tired, but they're not ready to be under the rule of Vladimir Putin.
Yeah. And real quick, Ukrainian President Zelensky, what has he been saying about this process? Who has he been meeting with?
Well, says he will sign on to a deal for a ceasefire, but I spoke to a military analyst last night, and he said, look, there is no document that can bring peace. There is a document that could bring a ceasefire, and that's the only thing we hope for. And I said, what about security guarantees? Do you need the Americans and NATO? He said, the only security guarantees that will help us is the Ukrainian military. The Ukrainians know they have to rely on themselves. They know that Putin will not stop this war.
That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley again in Kyiv. Eleanor, thank you. Take good care.
Thank you.
If you're a parent with a younger kids, your ears might have perked up when billionaires Michael and Susan Dell announced they'll deposit $250 into investment accounts for millions of American kids. Here's Michael Dell on CNBC yesterday.
These accounts can be used when the child turns 18, it becomes like an IRA. They can use it for education, for starting a business, for buying a home, for starting a family, for continued savings.
So how's this going to work? Let's bring in Waylon Wong, host of The Indicator from NPR's Planet Money. Hi, Waylon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. You know, the thing that strikes me about this, it's having really rich private citizens step in to fund a government program. Is this unusual?
I think it's unusual in basically every way. It's unusual to have a private citizen, like you said, come in and give such a large gift to the federal government for this program. And it's unusual, I think, in the world of philanthropy as well. This is not a rich person who's, you know, funding a hospital or a museum wing or setting up some kind of nonprofit program. It's direct giving, which is what Michael Dell said he wanted to do because it matches what he did with his computer business.
Let's talk about how it would work. The money would complement the so-called Trump accounts that Republicans approved with their tax and spending bill this summer, and that would fund investment accounts for babies. So how does the Dell money fit in?
Right. So the Trump accounts would give $1,000 to kids with a social security number who are born between January 1st, 2025 and December 31st, 2028. So that's basically the Trump term, right? And so Michael Dell is coming in with this huge gift, and he's giving $250 to older kids. So these are kids who are born between 2016 and 2024, so they missed the cutoff for the Trump accounts. And these kids also live in zip codes where the median household income is below $150,000 a year. So it is targeted towards kids who might come from families whose incomes are a little lower.
But you know what I think is interesting about that? There's nothing that says, so far at least, that you have to be poor to get this money, because anyone could live in a zip code that with a household income is less than $150,000.
Absolutely. So this is a universal program. It's like a little bit targeted, but it does have kind of a universal quality to it because, yeah, you will have in a zip code a variety of income levels, and a kid from a very well-off family will get the same $250 that a kid from a lower income family would get.
Interesting. So now, to me, the big question here is whether these baby bonds or investing this money for newborns or young kids, would it help close the wealth gap in this country? And that's something that a lot of economists have debated for a long time. What do we know about whether this idea would even work?
Yeah, you know what's interesting is I think when you are trying to evaluate this kind of program based on whether it will move the needle on the wealth gap, you have to think about the difference between wealth and income, right? And how wealth is transmitted through generations. And we think of that as, you know, owning a house and having equity in a house, or you think about having, you know, a trust fund, or you think about, you know, having a family that can pay for college so you don't have to take on a ton of debt to go to school, for example. And so these are ways that generational wealth is transmitted in this country. And when you look at these accounts and, you know, getting seeded with, let's say, $1,000 or $250, depending on where you fall with those cutoff dates, it's, you know, it does take advantage of kind of the miracle of compound interest, right? And this is money that's going to be invested in the stock market, which, you know, has on average much higher returns than kind of the natural rate of interest you would get from, let's say, like a savings account. But I think it's, you know, it's interesting to look at the numbers and to crunch the numbers, because if you look at, you know, what the White House says about the Trump account, so these are for the $1,000 accounts, it says that, you know, if you don't make any contributions because you're allowed to contribute to this if you want, but if you only get the $1,000 from the government and you never put anything else in, by age 18, you'll have $5,800, which is a nice amount of money, but it's not enough for a down payment. It's
right.
not enough. It's not a life-changing amount of money. And so in that way, you know, I interviewed an economist about this about a year ago. And, you know, she said you should think about this as more income than wealth, because it's, if you never contribute to it, then the amount you get, even, you know, with, like, let's assume like a 10% rate of return, for example, it's not quite enough to launch you in this way that builds wealth. So it's,
but
again,
here's the thing, and
I want to
interrupt you because I don't have a lot of time. This is an important point, because you can either contribute to it or you don't. And there's a big difference. So I wonder if this money wouldn't be better off coming out with some kind of financial literacy to help people navigate what can be a pretty complex tool. Just briefly.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you should think about these Trump accounts not as a cure-all for the wealth gap or anything else, but kind of one tool in an arsenal of tools that people should be using to think about building wealth and narrowing the wealth gap.
All right. Waylon Wong hosts The Indicator from NPR's Planet Money. Thanks so much for this. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now.
Midterms are less than a year away, and election officials across the country are already preparing for the possibility of interference by the Trump administration.
At this point, I think we're all just kind of used to, all right, what's the next crazy hairball thing that's going to pop up?
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What election officials are watching for as midterms draw closer on All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll keep you informed of the next thing. Stay with us. All Things Considered Early Edition and the latest news at 1.
We get it. AI bots and algorithms are overfeeding you with too many options. Why not enjoy human recommendations from the experienced critics on the KQED Arts and Culture team? At the end of this year, we're looking back on the best of 2025. The best art exhibits, plays, and albums from the Bay Area. The movies that set our hearts on fire, and the tastiest restaurant dishes. You can find it all at kqed.org/arts.
Support for KQED comes from Philharmonia Baroque, presenting Vivaldi's Gloria in a holiday concert that transports audiences to 18th century Venice. December 5th through 7th in SF, Berkeley, and Stanford. Details at philharmonia.org/gloria. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a vehicle is easy. We'll make all the arrangements and invest the funds back into our news coverage. And you can learn more at kqed.org/cars.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 55 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com.
It's Here and Now. I don't want them in our country. Those are the words President Trump had yesterday for Somali migrants living in the United States. He went on to call them and Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar garbage.
We're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country. Ilhan Omar is garbage. She's garbage. Her friends are garbage. These aren't people that work. These aren't people that say, let's go, come on, let's make this place great. These are people that do nothing but complain.
Congresswoman Omar is Somali-American and a fierce critic of the president. All this is happening, meanwhile, as the White House is reportedly planning new immigration sweeps in Minnesota to target the community. Madison McVann is a reporter with the Minnesota Reformer. Madison, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard the president's words. Here's St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter at a press conference yesterday in response.
We saw, sadly, the president of the United States open his mouth to take a whole group of people, a whole country of people, and denigrate just based on where they come from. And somehow we found ourselves to a place where that doesn't surprise any of us.
So we should say Minnesota has one of the largest communities of Somalis in the country. Does what we just heard from the mayor kind of sum up how the community is feeling right now?
Yeah, certainly. What we're hearing so far is that folks are just fearful of what this means for them. It's hard to get numbers on, you know, the exact immigration status of, you know, certain population groups, but we do know that the majority of Somali people in Minnesota are here legally, and a large percentage are citizens. So I think they're concerned about what this means for them, you know, as people with legal status as well.
The president made this comment yesterday at a cabinet meeting. It kind of came out of nowhere. Do we know why the president's rhetoric all of a sudden just escalated against the Somali community in Minnesota? I mean, is that clear?
Yeah, we do know why. I mean, it's this story goes back several years, dating back to fraud in a pandemic era government program that's been covered intensively by local media. A couple weeks ago, a conservative magazine published an article claiming that Minnesota taxpayers are the largest funder of Al-Shabaab, which is a terrorist organization in Somalia. There's very little evidence to back up that claim, but the authors of this article are the same ones who got Republicans fired up about critical race theory a couple years ago. So it quickly got the attention of the president, drew his attention to the fraud in Minnesota and his targeting of Somali immigrants.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about this fraud scandal that has swept up some folks in Minnesota. The federal prosecutors have charged dozens of people with felonies, and the allegations is that they stole, you know, more than $1 billion from a government program that was meant to keep children fed during the pandemic. Many of those involved were part of the Somali community. So what do we know as a matter of fact about that investigation?
Right. So you're correct. Dozens of people have been charged. This program is, well, we refer to this trial as the Feeding Our Future trial. Feeding Our Future is one of the nonprofits that has been charged with fraud. The government program was meant to feed kids during the pandemic. And essentially, people started setting up fake businesses and nonprofits. They claimed to feed kids, but then they didn't actually feed them. And instead, they pocketed the money. We know that money was spent on things like cars, jewelry, vacations, property in Kenya and in the United States. But no one has been charged with terrorism financing, although, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota has charged people with that before. So to our knowledge, based on what's come out at trial so far, that has not been the case.
I see. So at the same time that the president has made these comments, there are reports that ICE operations will target Somali immigrants in the Twin Cities later this week. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot we don't know. The reports came out yesterday morning, and local leaders and community organizers are still scrambling to find out what exactly this will look like. We know that around 100 ICE agents will be deployed out here, you know, with the goal of targeting the Somali community. You know, most of the Somali people in Minnesota live in Minneapolis, so we suspect that's where we'll see people, or where we'll see operations, but we just don't have confirmation yet of what exactly it'll look like.
Just a minute to go here, but what have we heard from Congresswoman Ilhan Omar? She was a direct target in the comments yesterday from the president.
Right. She said something on Twitter pretty shortly after, basically saying that she hopes the president seeks help. She's been a frequent target of his, you know, as a Somali woman in Congress. You know, he's, you know, frequently called for her to be deported. You know, she's a citizen. She does represent the area of Minneapolis that's home to Somali immigrants. So is kind of seen as a representative of that community in Congress for sure.
Madison McVann, a reporter with the Minnesota Reformer. Thank you.
Thank you.
U.S. wine sales have been, let's call it, tipsying downward for about 6 years now. And here's the thing. More wineries are popping up in places like the American Heartland. So what does a smaller market mean for these grape growers and crushers and winemakers? Here's Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer.
On an early morning in mid-September, sunlight floods a vineyard surrounded by cornfields in northern Iowa. The grape harvest began half an hour ago with a machine pulled by a small tractor. It combs the trellises, shaking grapes off the vine. A conveyor belt pulls them into a bin. Ann Zwink is an award-winning winemaker at Soldier Creek Winery.
We're actually harvesting four varieties today because everything became ripe all at once last week in the heat.
One of those grape varieties is La Crescent. She says its cold hardiness and disease resistance makes it a staple for wine in Iowa and other parts of the Midwest.
It produces a really delicious orange muscat type of aroma. So like orange blossom, tea, honey, citrus.
Zwink says the harvest this year is lower than average. The vines are still recovering from a four-year drought. Herbicides also drifted in from nearby fields, damaging a few acres. But she says the biggest challenge for her family's winery and others around the state are sales.
We have a really hard cash flow problem right now, where we have a lot of money in the tanks, and it's hard to actually sell the product that's in the tank.
And they're not the only ones with this issue.
Globally in the U.S., you know, wine sales are on the decline.
That's Randall Voss, a fruit crop field specialist with Iowa State University Extension. He says part of it has to do with more competition from hard seltzers and canned cocktails. But American adults who say they drink alcohol has also dropped to 54%, according to a recent Gallup poll. That's the lowest on record in nearly 90 years.
Right now, we have a greater supply of grapes than demand. And so it's a challenge in that, what do, right? Do you ride it out and hopefully in a couple of years it'll be better? Or do you pull out that vineyard and that's a long-term decision?
Texas recently emerged as one of the top wine producers in the U.S., but the state is also seeing a dip in sales. Michael Cook is a viticulturalist with Texas A&M Extension.
Yes, things are slowing down right now, but there's hope that, you know, this slump will bounce back very quickly.
Florida, New York, and California have experienced the largest wine consumption losses by volume. But in Texas, tourism is helping to keep its wineries afloat.
The Hill Country is kind of what most people think about when they think about Texas wine. A lot of it is because it's so close to Austin and San Antonio, and there's tons of tourism associated with the wine industry there.
This includes live music, food, and festivals. Southern Illinois is another area that draws in people from around the region. Ryan Phelps, a winemaker and grape grower at Clad & Cordon, says there's opportunity for growth.
I mean, I think in our area, people are probably even putting in more vines. I know we are personally.
Back at Soldier Creek Winery, Ann Swink and her family sanitize equipment to crush and ferment several tons of grapes from their Iowa vineyard. She says the winery hosts live music and other events to draw people in, but northern Iowa is largely farmland. It's not a major tourist destination.
We're finding that we have to constantly be creating something new in order to keep interest there and to follow the trends of what consumers want.
They're producing hard cider and experimenting with new grapes. Even if those efforts are successful for just a year, Swink says it's worth it. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Kramer.
This afternoon, on All Things Considered, what the Trump administration's plan for heavy tariffs on imported pasta from Italy could mean for spaghetti night in your home. All the news, including the news you can slurp, hear it on the NPR app or your dependable local public radio station. This is Here and Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Josie Guarino. The Department of Homeland Security is launching a new immigration crackdown in New Orleans, saying the operation that got underway today will target violent criminals. New Orleans Police Chief Ann Kirkpatrick has said she considers immigration enforcement to be a civil matter outside her jurisdiction. The administration has said it aims to arrest 5,000 people. Local authorities say that number is unrealistic if the operation's targeting only dangerous suspects. Republican Matt Van Epps narrowly won a nationally watched special election in Tennessee for a U.S. House seat, maintaining his party's grip on the conservative district. But the slim margin of victory is fueling Democratic hopes for next year's midterms as the party looks to regain power in Washington. His win allows the GOP to retain the seat previously held by former Representative Mark Green, who resigned in July to take a private sector job. Costco is now one of the largest companies to sue the Trump administration over sweeping import tariffs. Dozens of companies across the industries have filed lawsuits to seek refunds in the event that the Supreme Court finds Trump's tariffs illegal. The Supreme Court is weighing the future of President Trump's tariffs on nearly all imports. Justices seemed skeptical about the tariffs' legality during last month's oral arguments. This is Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from Gardens of Golden Gate Park. Lightscape at San Francisco Botanical Garden opens November 21st. Visitors are invited to a luminous blend of art, sound, and nature that transforms the garden after dark. Tickets at ggp.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. Gusty winds at times today around the Bay Area and the Sacramento Valley. Bay Area gusty winds, some gusts up to 45, dropping down a bit to 35 this afternoon. Sacramento Valley, some gusts up to 40, decreasing to 30 later in the afternoon. Looking ahead for the Bay Area, the Weather Service says no rain is forecast in the next several days, at least through the weekend.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. and MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Here and Now. So what's your personality type? Well, turns out you don't need that Myers-Briggs test because we have YouTube. Yeah, YouTube has a brand new spiffed up feature summarizing what you watched in 2025. And based on the recap, the app gives you a personality type, serenity seeker or dreamer or bashful. Okay, I made that last one up. But let's talk about YouTube and what is happening there with Eleanor Hawkins, a writer for Axios. She's also communications strategist there. Eleanor, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, YouTube recap. Please explain, what is it?
So the way that, YouTube is framing it is it's putting you in YouTube. It's pulling your top videos, your top artists, and giving you a year in review. It's very, very similar to what Spotify does every year. Spotify's is called Spotify Wrapped. Basically, what both of these platforms are doing is they're taking all of the data, all of the information they have about individual users, and then compiling it into a very shareable, basically report of how the users are engaging across the platforms. And then the users are sharing them across social media and creating even more fanfare around these platforms.
Yeah, YouTube, the Pew Research data is striking, right? YouTube dominant, 84% of people who respondents said they use YouTube, followed by Facebook and then Instagram. What do you glean from the data as far as who is on YouTube, who is leaving other places to go there?
So YouTube is really interesting because it is the most widely used platform among teens and those between the ages of 18 and 29. And then those between 30 and 49 also use it in a large quantity, 92%. So it's definitely a younger audience. We found that Facebook is a popular destination for more senior audiences. And in fact, what we found is that all platforms, with the exception of X, have seen a dramatic increase in use across all generations since 2021.
And one nugget I kind of saw that was interesting, TikTok, by these numbers, lures more women, more Black and Hispanic users by the data. You know, by contrast, they say Instagram goes up by income. TikTok is the opposite. Just curious what you kind of see in some of these sub-numbers.
Yeah, it's really interesting to slice the data. I think it's particularly interesting for advertisers to get a better sense of who is on the platform, who is engaging the platform. The other thing that I think is interesting is the role that AI is going to play. We're seeing that LLMs are starting to also pull information from these platforms.
See, these large language models, right? These big AI programs, yes, they're taking data, aggregating data from these social media platforms.
Right. Reddit is a huge funnel for these large language models. And, you know, probably unsurprisingly, Google's model, Gemini, is most likely to cite YouTube, their sister company. So I think AI as an audience is something that creators and brands are also thinking about when they engage on these platforms.
I see. So just to make sure I understand you, if I go, say, on Google Gemini, I put in a query or something, what's happening in the background is of all the data that Gemini is kind of aggregating for its answer, YouTube content is going to be a significant part of what it spits out. Yeah?
Yeah, it's definitely a source that they pull from.
All right. Eleanor Hawkins is a writer and communications strategist at Axios. Eleanor, good to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. Thanks.
It's Here and Now.
Prices for everything from cars to coffee are soaring, but you can count on some things getting cheaper because they have been for decades. Computers. Storing and processing information has gotten more efficient and more cost-effective over time.
The number of transistors incorporated in a chip will approximately double every 24 months.
But will that last? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, continuous local news. Listen live on 88.5 KQED News or use our KQED app. Real-time updates all day long. Morning Edition tomorrow at 2.
I'm Katie DiBenedetti, a digital reporter with KQED. You helped us hit our goal yesterday, and we're keeping the Giving Newsday momentum going. All gifts today are matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000. turn up the volume and double your impact at kqed.org/donate.
Support comes from visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com. And the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir, a beloved Bay Area tradition. Their holiday concert uplifts, inspires, and celebrates the joy of the season. December 6th, Oakland Paramount Theater. Info at oigc.org/holiday.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and your NPR station, and from the Museum of Science Boston, where visitors can experience live presentations with outdoor lightning storms, animals, robotics, and hands-on design challenges. Learn more at mos.org. And Rhodes Scholar, celebrating 50 years of transformative learning adventures for adults in over 100 countries. Learn more at rhodesscholar.org/explore.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. The Department of Homeland Security says federal agents started an operation today in New Orleans to crack down on illegal immigration. DHS, in a statement today, said its agents are targeting violent criminals who were arrested for crimes like robbery or rape and then released under the city's sanctuary policies. Louisiana's Republican Governor Jeff Landry supports the federal immigration operation, but immigrant rights activists are warning residents to stay indoors if they are at risk of detention. Helena Moreno, the Democratic mayor-elect of New Orleans, calls this deployment concerning. She said the city would monitor the agent's work closely. Moreno takes office on January 12th, and we will continue to monitor developments there.
We're also following developments in the Middle East, where Hamas says it's returned the remains of one of the last two hostages in Gaza. Israel has said it will open the Rafah border crossing from Gaza into Egypt after Hamas returns all the hostages. Now, Palestinians want that crossing open because, as the World Health Organization reports, more than 16,000 people in Gaza need to leave to get medical care. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli settlers continue their attacks on Palestinians and activists. The Guardian reports a Canadian and three Italian activists were beaten up and robbed over the weekend in the occupied territory while trying to protect Palestinians.
We have reported extensively on those developments in the Middle East, but back here in the States, many Jewish Americans have become increasingly critical of Israel. Some are even shifting away from their long-held belief in Zionism. Michigan Public's Beinish Ahmed spoke to members of one Detroit-area synagogue as they reckon with their beliefs.
Rabbi Alana Alper sings for the start of Rosh Hashanah for the couple hundred people gathered at her congregation. Her big white glasses match the white shawl draped over her shoulders. A lot of people in the pews also wear white, symbolic of the purification sought between the holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. A few also wear keffiyehs, woven scarves that signify Palestinian resistance. Over the last 2 years, Congregation Tehillah members have tried to understand the Palestinian experience. Many ultimately disavowed the version of Zionism they once held sacrosanct. For Alpert, the question wasn't if she would mention Gaza in her sermon, but how much she would talk about it.
It is not enough to be a Jew against genocide. You must be a part of a Jewish community against genocide and for human rights.
Supporting Israel has been a cornerstone of the Jewish American experience, so it's hard to underscore just how rare Rabbi Alpert's efforts to center Palestinian experiences have been. But Congregation Tehillah is also rare. A lot of its members joined because they didn't feel they belonged in more traditional synagogues. Tehillah was founded on progressive values like inclusivity for queer people and interfaith families. A few years ago, Albert felt compelled to take a step back and ask,
what does it mean to be a social justice synagogue? And one of the things that it means is reckoning with Israel-Palestine.
And so in 2023, she led a group of Tehillah members on a trip to the West Bank. They came back and shared their experiences with the congregation. Then, just a few weeks later, Hamas attacked Israeli civilians on October 7th.
That was a heartbreak to me.
That's Victoria Cole. At first, the Tehillah members saw Israel's military response to Hamas's attack as justified.
So justified to not justified to not sustainable to now, if I may use the word, unforgivable.
Over the last 2 years, Cole says she's evolved from being a defender of Israel to a defender of Palestinian rights. She struggled to reconcile Israel's war on Gaza with her Jewish faith, especially verses from the Torah, like, justice, justice, you shall pursue. Cole says she had a safe space to work through her feelings in workshops and discussions at Tehillah, facilitated by Albert.
She allowed me to voice disagreements. It was very enlightening to know that my congregation was able, we were able to talk to each other and come to a fairly common place.
Fellow Tehillah member Seema Ajindia has been on that journey too. Ajindia's grandparents lost most of their families during the Holocaust. She believed in Israel as a safe haven for Jewish people.
Honestly, we never thought about the other people that were already living there. I kind of thought everybody sort of blended in and there really wasn't much going on. That's why we said it was a desert. Nothing was happening there. So it didn't matter if the European Jews moved in, they would just elevate the place.
Ajindia is 82. She first visited Israel through a youth program after graduating from Jewish day school.
We spent 2 weeks getting there by boat.
Back then, Israel as a country was younger than she was. Ajindia became enamored by the possibility she saw around her. She went back 2 years later and this time fell in love with an Israeli man, the engineer of the boat.
It was a shipboard romance.
After the two married and started a family, Ajindia insisted they move to Israel.
I liked raising my kids there. I felt, at the time, I felt safe and comfortable.
For nearly a decade, the family lived in Ashkelon, a city on the border with Gaza. They moved back to the U.S. in 1987, but Ajindia visited Israel often. She didn't see life for Palestinians improving.
We were hearing more and more stories about how the settlements were ruining life for the people who were already living there.
Israeli settlements have displaced Palestinians and diverted resources away from them. Ajindia only began reflecting on those issues through programs at Tehillah. She had been involved in community activism, studied social work, and had a long career as a mental health administrator. The separate set of rights for Israelis and Palestinians didn't fit in with her belief in equality. Ajindia's late-in-life mind shift has alienated her from some of her family.
They see me as, you know, a self-hating Jew.
How does that feel for you?
It's very upsetting. It's very upsetting. It is, but there's no opportunity to talk about it. I mean, I can get upset. I cried one day to the rabbi and said, nobody will come to my funeral. And she said, what are you talking about? We'll all be there.
The congregation's critical approach to Zionism has also caused some members to leave, says Rabbi Albert.
Yeah, only a handful. But I have to say, like each one like pains me really deeply, like, because yeah, in the Jewish tradition, it's talk about kind of each person being an olam male, like a complete world. And I feel that.
At the Rosh Hashanah service, there's laughter when Rabbi Alpert swears once, encouraging people to come back to shul.
Come when it's convenient, come when it's not, come when you're inspired, come when you're exhausted, come when the Torah speaks to you, and come when it feels like ancient gibberish. Come when you like the rabbi, and come when you think I'm full of it. Come because your presence here is an act of resistance against the forces that want to isolate us, atomize us, make us forget that we belong to each other. Am I right?
For the last 2 years, Congregation Tehillah has offered a prayer for peace during every Shabbat. And though it's fragile, the latest ceasefire agreement finally gave them an answer to that prayer. For Here and Now, I'm Beenish Ahmed.
This is Here and Now. Hackers are using AI to target corporations, governments, and maybe even you. What can you do about it? Find out next time in Here and Now.
Hear more. That's coming up starting at noon on the second hour of Here and Now. Support for KQED comes from SF Fire Credit Union, owned and operated by members who strive to protect the financial security of their community. SF Fire Credit Union, rescuing you from banks. More at sffirecu.org. And Rising Team, creator of Super Manager AI, giving leaders at all levels a leadership personal trainer and coaching partner to help build essential skills, practice hard conversations, and strengthen team performance. Learn more at supermanager.ai.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And CitySpace Productions, WBUR's creative studio for custom podcasts that tell a brand story to ignite engagement, reach new audiences, or enhance customer connections. WBUR.org/creative studio.
It's Here and Now. If someone you love has been diagnosed with dementia, there is a new glimmer of hope. Scientists believe the shingles vaccine may slow down the progression of symptoms. A new study in the journal Cell bolsters research from earlier this year that found the vaccine lowers the risk of developing dementia by 20%. Pascal Goldsetzer is at Stanford University. He's the senior author of the study. Pascal, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I know we need to be cautious here, but a lot of very respected scientists are encouraged by this work you've been doing. What did you find?
Yeah, we're very excited about this work because of these unique date of birth eligibility cutoffs that they used for the shingles vaccine rollout. In the UK, we had very clean comparison groups, and I think that's why we're so excited about these large protective effects that we're seeing in our data, both for developing a diagnosis of dementia, that was our earlier study, and now in this follow-up study, also protective effects for mild cognitive impairment, so a pre-dementia stage, if you like, as well as benefits already among those who have the condition by the time that they get vaccinated.
Right, and I want to ask you about that. It seems to me that one reason this is so exciting is that there really isn't a treatment available for people who have already been diagnosed with dementia. So how protective could the shingles vaccine be for those people?
So we see large reductions in your probability of dying from dementia among those who already have dementia at the time of becoming eligible for the shingles vaccine. These effects, they're not replaced by other causes of death, so we're really extending remaining life expectancy among these individuals. And yes, these effects are certainly much larger than for existing pharmacological tools. Of course, we don't yet know exactly what the mechanism is, how exactly symptoms are affected by this vaccine, but it's certainly looking very promising.
We're talking about the shingles vaccine, which has, of course, nothing to do with dementia. Why did anyone think this might be helpful in the first place?
Well, the shingles vaccine acts on the chickenpox virus, and the chickenpox virus is a virus that remains with you, hibernated in your nervous system for life. And it's certainly very plausible from a biological perspective that a virus that is in your nervous system and in this constant interplay with the immune system may well cause some sort of inflammatory process. And we know inflammation is a bad thing for chronic diseases, including for dementia. So there's a lot of biological plausibility there that reducing these reactivations through shingles vaccination may well have benefits.
You mentioned the vaccine that you studied was from people who'd received it in the 1930s in the United Kingdom, I believe, and that formula isn't in use anymore. Is that right? So do you know if the current shingles vaccine would be just as effective?
We don't know. We can, of course, speculate. Certainly, if we think that the mechanism is through reducing reactivations of this virus, then we would think the newer vaccine may have even more benefits for dementia because it's more efficacious at reducing these reactivations. But it may also be the case that there is a more virus-independent boost to the immune system, if you like, that's at play here, or at least partially. And if that's the case, that could well vary by type of vaccine and may well be specific to this old life attenuated vaccine.
So if I'm hearing you, I guess this is a good endorsement for people to get the shingles vaccine now more than ever. Is that right?
Broadly, older population groups appear to be benefiting, and there certainly is very little harm to getting the shingles vaccine. So I think this only provides additional motivation to get the shingles vaccine, even if you're in a younger age group.
Yeah. As I said, there's no effective treatment for dementia, and as you know, it's a devastating diagnosis for people and their families. How hopeful are you, not just as a scientist, but as a human being, that you might be close to something here?
I mean, as a researcher and a human being, being able to do this research and seeing these protective effects in data set after data set, also from different countries that have rolled out the vaccine using these specific date of birth cutoffs, just an effect that keeps replicating and is something that's really exciting. As the next step really here, I think what the dream is to conclusively test this link between shingles vaccination and dementia using a clinical trial. And so that's the project that I'm really now putting all my energy into to try to get off the ground. And I think if we can show this conclusively in a clinical trial, then we have a really promising tool for patients who are worried about dementia, as well as those who are already suffering from the condition.
Pascal Geltzetze is an assistant professor at Stanford University, senior author of a study that's linked the shingles vaccine to protecting the brain against dementia. It published this week in the journal Cell. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington. You are listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com.
Clipper is coming out with a bunch of new features this month, and they're designed to save riders money and modernize how they pay for transit. I wrote a guide about the changes that are coming to Clipper, including discounted transfers for people that switch from one transit agency to another, and updates to how people can add value to their Clipper cards. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, and I'm a reporter for KQED. You can find my guide on kqed.org/explainers.
Turning from Clipper cards and transit over to traffic with Julie Depesh now at 11:59 as we go to Fremont.
Hi there, Dave. They are clearing this wreck in Fremont. North 680 is before Mission Boulevard South. Couple vehicles no longer blocking. They're over on the right-hand shoulder. Little trouble in San Jose. Northbound 101 is the off-ramp to Tully Road. Crash there on the right shoulder of the off-ramp. Mill Valley dealing with the king tides this afternoon. The northbound 101 connector ramp to Highway 1. That's shut down until 2 o'clock. Julie Depesh for KQED.
Traffic support from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Member supported.